Strap on your parachute. It's time for What Goes Up with Sarah Ponczek and Mike Regan.
Hello, and welcome to What Goes Up, a Bloomberg Weekly Markets podcast. I'm Sarah Ponczek, a reporter on the Cross Asset team.
And I'm Mike Regan, a senior editor at Bloomberg, and you can think of me as the Bon Iver to Sarah's Taylor Swift.
There we go, Mike. I believe it's Bon Iver, though.
Oh, geez. Of course I blew it.
But you'll get him
here
next time.
Here I was thinking I finally had a contemporary reference, and I totally blew it. Bon Iver? That's ridiculous.
Bon Iver, I believe that's how it's pronounced.
Forget
Maybe
it.
I'm wrong,
Forget
but I'm pretty
it.
Sure. For all of us fans of the new Taylor Swift album, Mike had a good pairing for my coming back from my week off. But this week on the show, Mike, a pioneer of research on the yield curve now has some words of wisdom to share about gold as the spot price of the precious metal trades at record levels. Our guest wrote a paper on gold just this month, and he says massive passive ownership could possibly lead to a period of quote-unquote irrational exuberance.
And as always, we'll close out the episode with our tradition, the craziest thing I saw in markets this week. So if you saw something crazy and want to give us a heads up, give us a call on the Bloomberg podcast hotline at 646-324-3490 and leave us a voicemail. Maybe we'll play it on the show. And Sarah, as you mentioned, you're back from vacation. Listeners don't realize this, but you're also back in New York City, back in your apartment. I think the last time we recorded a podcast with you in your apartment, your neighbors started playing some jazz upstairs. So I'm fingers crossed, I'm kind of hoping that happens again.
If we're lucky, maybe he'll play some Taylor Swift for us.
That's right. And I was watching some videos of our guest this week, and I noticed he has, there's this service or this thing on Twitter, and it's not a service, it's some guy on Twitter called Room Raider, Sarah, where they go and they look at the rooms people are doing their Zoom meetings from. Our guest this week has one of the coolest rooms I've seen. Very well appointed, but I think there's either a cello or a stand-up bass behind him. So maybe he'll get on and jam with the guy above you if the jazz breaks out. That's what I'm hoping. Let's introduce our guest and see if his room's been rated. I personally give it a high rating because I was watching his videos and I kept getting distracted by his cool room. Anyway, he is a finance professor at Duke University's Business School. He's also a senior advisor at Research Affiliates. You may remember him from the show about a year ago. He was a guest, and we're going to talk to him a little bit about some of the things he had to say back then because they ended up being pretty prescient. Anyway, his name is Cam Harvey. Cam, welcome to the show.
Great to be on the show, Sarah and Mike.
Now, Cam, I wanted to start off. Sarah talked about this new paper you have out on the gold, and it's pretty fascinating to me because, as you point out in some of the discussions about this paper, gold, we have a data set that goes back, I don't know what, thousands of years, basically. You know, if you want to know the price of gold in Roman times, we know what it was. And one of the really interesting things, as Sarah will point out, I tend to latch on to the craziest things in reports like this. And one of the craziest and most interesting things you pointed out was that the price of gold paid as a wage to soldiers in ancient Rome, if you translate it to sort of the modern value of gold today, it's basically similar to the wage that an officer in the army would be making right now if they were paid in gold, which to me kind of blows my mind since it sort of backs up one of the common theses for gold in that it's a good store of value. Clearly, it's hedged inflation on wages since Roman times. But as you also point out, it's a very unreliable inflation hedge. I guess if your holding period is measured in centuries, it's perfect. But otherwise, it's not as a reliable store value inflation hedge as people might think. Walk us through basically the main points of that paper along those lines, because I really find it to be a really fascinating look on something that has been a cornerstone of financial assets for forever, pretty much.
Sure. And there's actually two papers. My paper in 2013 in the Financial Analyst Journal with Claude Erb, we actually did this exercise that you described, that the Romans kept great records. And you could figure out exactly what a Roman centurion was paid. And we actually have the coins, so you can figure out what the gold content or the silver content actually is. And we worked out that they were paid 38 troy ounces of gold a year. And you're right, that that's approximately the wage of a U.S. Army captain. So that means that gold has held its value. We've got another example of a loaf of bread from the time of Nebuchadnezzar, so it's even earlier. And that translates into about $5.50 in terms of the gold equivalent today, which is about what I pay at a boutique bakery for a high-end loaf of bread. So over the very long term, gold is something that holds its value. So another way to think about this is that the inflation-adjusted value of gold is approximately constant through time, so it doesn't degrade. But the problem is that gold is volatile. So gold has the same volatility as the S&P 500. So there can be large swings in value where it is a poor inflation hedge for decades or potentially centuries. And then all of a sudden it's a good inflation hedge for a decade or maybe a century. So it's very unreliable in terms of hedging inflation.
So we've seen this pretty mad rush to gold in recent weeks. I mean, in your paper recently, you looked at the inflation adjusted price of gold near the highs of 1980s, right at the levels that we saw back in 2011. If gold currently is priced at such high levels relative to inflation, should investors rightly be believing that this will actually be a good inflation hedge going forwards?
So again, our analysis and our most recent paper, which was just posted, actually it was the day of gold's all-time high that we posted this paper. And so, and this is also with Claude Erb and Tadas Vasconta. And we do know that gold in, I guess, 1980 in today's prices was about 2,200. And in 2011, in August, it was about 2,100. So we're very close to the all-time high in inflation-adjusted terms. So we hit a nominal high, not taking inflation into account. But in 1980, it was definitely bad news for investors. If you're buying in 1980, over the next 5 years, you lost 55%. If you're a buyer in 2011, in August, over the next 5 years, you lost 28%. So what you see, and this is in our paper, what you see are these fluctuations. So we look at the average inflation adjusted price, and sometimes you're above and sometimes you're below, but there's a tendency to revert to the mean. And right now we're way above that average price. So think of that average price as the constant inflation-adjusted price of gold. Sometimes you're above, sometimes you're below, and today you're way above.
You know, Cameron, one of the things you talk about is, you know, you sort of quote Warren Buffett and describe them as bandwagon type of investors who pile into gold because it's had such a good run. Sort of, I guess you could consider them momentum investors to some degree. And you talk about how the ETFs holding gold perhaps playing a large role in this boom in the prices. Now, to me, I would think, well, if ETFs are here to stay, that's kind of a permanent new source of investors and speculators in gold. Would that suggest to you a sort of a permanent higher inflation adjusted price, or would it suggest more of the volatility you're talking about? Would it perhaps accentuate the volatility when there is all this money in ETFs chasing gold?
So basically what we do in our paper is to show that there's a very strong correlation between the real price of gold, or the inflation adjusted price of gold, and the number of troy ounces that the leading gold ETFs hold. So this time might be different, as you say. So in 1980, we didn't have any gold ETFs. And retail investors, the whole gold, it was very difficult to do. You could buy coins, but they're very expensive relative to the bullion price. You could buy bullion, but then you have to vault it and pay for that. And it's really difficult to buy and sell gold. So the ETFs made it a lot easier for investors to actually hold gold. And I do think that in a diversified portfolio, people should have some real assets. And gold is one of those real assets. And other commodities, real estate, things like that, it makes sense. The problem is the following. The problem is that this strong correlation between the price and the holdings of the gold ETFs is very suggestive of the following type of behavior. As the price goes up, investors buy more. And as the price goes up even more, investors continue to buy. And this is the opposite to what I teach. So what I teach is a good investment strategy is to buy low and sell high. It appears what's going on here is that investors are buying high. And I do quote Buffett's famous line, and that is, he's referring to gold investors as bandwagon investors. And he says, as bandwagon investors join any party, they create their own truth for a while. And what that means is that you see the price going up, you jump on the bandwagon, you buy some of the gold ETF, and the gold ETF has to purchase gold, and the price actually goes up. And that is creating their own truth. Their investment thesis is validated as the price goes up, but the party just doesn't last forever. So I do worry about this. You mentioned this is like a momentum effect, and not quite. Trend followers are really careful on this, and that when the trend is really, really strong, they de-risk. So this is much different than a bandwagon effect where people just piling into this risky asset. And to be clear, this is just like a risk asset. Look, in March of 2020, the stock market tanked, gold plummeted, and the new gold, Bitcoin, lost over 50% of its value. And then when we got to risk on, people got more comfortable that we're going to get through the COVID-19. The stock market goes up and gold goes up. So this is just a speculative tool. And as with speculation, there'll be some winners and there's going to be some losers.
I was looking at total assets in GLD, which is the really popular gold ETF, just now, well, recently hitting a record high above $80 billion. So it's pretty unbelievable. But Cam, I want to get your take because I feel like whenever we hear from investors lately who are now bullish on gold, pretty much every single time they point to the level of real interest rates. Right now, 10-year real yield at negative 1% or so at record lows. How do you factor this in to any analysis on gold and what we might see as it pertains to volatility in real assets when you consider the fact that we do have real interest rates at levels pretty much never seen before?
So we've addressed this, and there it is true that since, let's say, 2004, there is a strong negative correlation between the price of gold and the level of real or nominal interest rates. So that correlation is really clear. However, that correlation is unstable. So if you go back before 2004, that correlation could be zero or it could be positive. So looking at the most recent data, you need to be really careful because that correlation could be what we call spurious. So I'd be very, very careful on this. I have much more faith in our analysis of the holdings of gold ETFs. That kind of makes sense. They're holding more gold, they gotta buy more gold, and the price is positively correlated with it. So yes, there is, using the most recent data, this negative correlation between the rates and gold prices, but I would just be really, really careful on that.
Okay, one more question on gold, and then I think we want to move on to the yield curve. And I know, you know, a guy like you, you like to study the math, the statistical relationships, and the hard data. So this might be a question that is not answerable from that sort of approach, but I'm just curious if you have thoughts on it. And it's something that's I've never quite been able to wrap my head around when it comes to gold is what explains the appeal of gold over literally centuries? Like you said, why is it that Roman soldiers were willing to get paid in gold way back when, and that value of that payday is the same as it is today? I mean, does it all relate back just to the simple sort of physical demand for gold, that it's a shiny, pretty metal, it's good for jewelry? Is it all, does it all hinge around that, do you think? Or is it just impossible to explain?
It is true that gold's been around for thousands of years. And I think part of it is that it does have this usefulness. So gold, 70% of gold is used in jewelry. It's used in some electronic parts also. So there's actually utility directly associated with gold. But I think part of the story is the safe haven too. This, this mystique that gold is the ultimate safe haven. So in our research, we actually reject that hypothesis. And we've got this great example called the Hoxne Hoard. And it's from the countryside of England. Somebody's repairing a fence and they drop their hammer. They look down and pick up the hammer, but they see a gold coin. They scrape the ground and they see more gold coins. This could only happen in England, but they immediately go to the university and seek out an archaeologist, and they excavate and they find this treasure chest filled with gold. And they date it to the time that the Romans were leaving England. So basically, this was the safe haven. So some family, they took their wealth, they buried it in a field, in a treasure chest. And the fact that we discovered it recently shows that it failed as a safe haven. That family never got access to it. So there is this mystique of a safe haven. There is this, this myth that gold is a short-term inflation hedge when it isn't. So I think that gold is very poorly understood, but you're correct that given that it's got such a long history and is part of our history, that that it gets treated differently and people are willing to ignore the evidence.
So Cam, we really can't have you on the show, as Mike alluded to, without discussing the yield curve. You are one of the pioneers of doing research on the subject. Your dissertation on the subject is also very, very widely cited. And we had you on the show to discuss it last May or so. And of course, after the yield curve inverted last year, we did achieve a recession. Now, of course, this could all be seen as hoopla or whatever you might want to call it, considering the fact that no one could predict the coronavirus. However, is it safe to say that, sure, I mean, the inversion of the yield curve did its job in predicting a recession?
So, yeah, you're correct that last year it was code red on the yield curve. So we had an inversion for a full quarter, and my model over the period since the 1960s, every time the yield curve inverted, a recession followed, and there were no false signals. So it was 7 out of 7, and it got the number 8 signal, which suggested recession. And you're correct, we're obviously in a recession right now. Did the yield curve predict the coronavirus? No, obviously not. We'll never know the counterfactual. We do know that recession was largely expected, at least from the Duke CFO survey, where up to 80% of the CFOs thought a recession would start by the first quarter of 2021. So again, we won't actually know, we can never know the counterfactual, but I guess We didn't know there was going to be an oil embargo in 1973 either. So the indicator is 8 for 8.
I'm counting it as a win, Cam. I'm putting it in the win column.
You know, sometimes you get lucky and sometimes unlucky. I'll take some of that luck.
That's right. Well, I don't know how lucky it is to have a recession to be able to predict it, but yeah, I'll count it as a win. Now, Cam, obviously now as we do start to take baby steps to get the economy reopened and back on track, there's a lot of very, you could call it exuberance in the stock market, not just the gold market. You know, we're seeing this really rip-roaring rally in stocks. Recently, we have seen the long end of the curve sort of come off the floor a little bit and rise a little bit of steepening in the curve. And that has everyone sort of turning their attention to the Federal Reserve. We'll have the Jackson Hole Symposium at the end of the month. And I feel like the bond market has really been speculating. I guess you could call it speculating, wishful thinking, hoping that the Fed will resort to some sort of yield curve control to keep that long end low in order to keep borrowing costs low and keep this recovery going. As a yield curve student like yourself, what's your reaction to that, to the notion that the Fed could potentially artificially bend the curve to its wishes? Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
So traditionally, the Fed has had control over the short-term part of the yield curve. And they would engage in open market operations and deal with the Fed funds rate. But we're in extraordinary times where this time around, we've got unlimited quantitative easing. And that means the whole curve is being influenced by the Fed. Will this be morphing into yield curve control? I certainly hope not. These actions are distortive. I don't think it's a great idea to have these really low or negative interest rates. It doesn't make any sense that in some countries you can get a mortgage where it's a negative rate. So you get paid every month to take out a mortgage. Does that make any sense?
Sign me up.
Or look at Japan. Yeah, look at Japan. That's a great example of yield curve control. Their bond market's gone. So the Japanese government bonds are just bought by the Bank of Japan. Is that the model that we actually want? So it is a very unusual situation. We are in a deep recession, yet the stock market has completely blown it off. And you're correct that you see some green shoots in the bond market also. So I really worry. I said irrational exuberance in gold, but at minimum, it's kind of a rose-colored glasses effect where people are not looking at the structural damage that's been done to our economy, the potential cost of the QE, the potential cost of having to pay back all of the fiscal stimulus. That's being completely ignored. And to me, that's very worrisome when you've got markets like this.
Well, we'll likely hear more about yield curve control next month at the Fed meeting. Cam, looking at the yield curve, though, right now, is there any signal that you can actually take away from it? And combining that with other signals that you look at, you mentioned the Duke CFO survey. Any recent results from that as well?
So the yield curve is positively sloped, which means that it's signaling economic growth. And I believe that's what's going to happen. So the recovery is not going to be V-shaped. But it will be a very strong recovery. And I think that that's consistent with the yield curve signal. Remember, the slope of the yield curve is telling us about expected future growth. So it's not just signaling recessions, it's also signaling a growth. So we will see that growth, but I doubt, given the slope, that growth is going to be robust. And yes, it might be that we get these really big numbers, but I think people need to understand the following. If you start at 100 and you drop by 50%, if the next quarter you gain 50%, you're not back to 100. You're only at 75. So you need to carefully look at this. It'll be a while before we actually get back to where we started. But again, markets don't seem to factor that in.
Yep. So these heady valuations in the equity market, I think a lot of people believe they're just unsustainable in the long run. You're not in the camp of believing in some sort of permanent higher plateau in valuations, I take it?
No, I'm not. And as you know, it's a very diverse situation. There's a lot of dispersion. So the behavior of the top 10 stocks in the S&P 500 much different than the other 490. So what we're seeing is a surge in growth stocks and relative to value stocks. And that difference between the growth and the value stocks, that basically we haven't seen that ever before. So what's happening to growth stocks seems to me very similar to what's happening with gold.
Well, I think it's that time.
It's that time, Mike.
Stand clear of the craziest things we saw in markets this week.
All right, Sarah, you're back from vacation. You had 2 full weeks to come up with a crazy thing. Hit us. What's the craziest thing you've seen?
All right. So maybe this is just a story of 2020, and it hits well this year. It's kind of got a bit of humor to it, also a bit crazy. On Wednesday, Penn National Gaming stock took a hit. But the reason it took a hit was after Dave Portnoy, who is the founder of Barstool Sports, posted a video of himself on Twitter saying that he was sick and that was the reason why he hadn't been streaming recently. He said, "Do I have COVID?" He wasn't sure, but he kind of assumed that he did. Anyway, just the idea that one person getting sick in the year of 2020 can hit a stock to the extent of 2% in a day, like, That's pretty crazy.
Well, yeah, it's crazy enough one person, but with that particular person, the fact that that guy can move the share price is, like you said, that's 2020 in a nutshell right there.
Right, 2020 in a nutshell. You can't escape it.
Pretty good one. How about you, Cam? Have you seen anything crazy in markets this year? I know it's been a very normal, quiet year in markets, but have you, what's popped out at you recently that's crazy?
The thing that's popped out that to me is very unexpected, and that is Berkshire Hathaway being long gold. So given the history of Warren Buffett and how negative he's been on gold when it's above or at a very kind of rich value, it's very surprising that Berkshire took this position and indicates to me that there's at least at minimum some disagreement within their portfolio management team.
I take it he's not a bystander in this case, or is he? Sounds like he might be.
He's
become what he once mocked, perhaps. That is interesting, though. I don't. I can't remember ever hearing Buffett long gold, but he's been sort of bearish about the whole recession and economy this year, anyway. But. Well, that's pretty good. 2 good ones. All right, I'll give you mine. Sarah, mine actually was given to me courtesy of our chief crazy things correspondent, Vildana Heirich. When you go on vacation, she has no choice but to cough them up to me.
She sends them to you instead of to me.
I know. It's pretty good.
No help for me this week, though.
Yeah, you're on your own. This is from a website, actionnetwork.com. It's written by Darren Revelle. He's a pretty famous sports business journalist. And it reports that an unopened case of 1986-1987 Fleer basketball cards, not even baseball cards, mind you, basketball cards, recently sold at an auction for $1,789,717. So almost $1.8 million for a big unopened box of basketball cards contained inside that big box, there were 12 boxes with 36 packs each. So I forget how many comes in a pack, maybe 20. So a lot of cards, but still for 1986-87 basketball season, $1.8 million for those cards. Sarah, that's not the crazy part, though. Here's what I think is the craziest part. You ready?
I'm ready.
I think whoever paid that, it was a steal. They got a bargain. And here's why. Because that particular year, a certain basketball player from North Carolina who did not go to Duke was a rookie in the NBA, Michael Jordan. And based on these past openings of these boxes, there's typically about 36 Michael Jordan rookie cards in this. And they, since this documentary about Jordan on ESPN, they've been selling in their neighborhood of $80,000 to $97,000 wow. each per card. So this guy, whoever, or this man or woman, whoever paid $1.8 million for these cards, if they get that many Jordan cards, theoretically they're looking at about a $3 million asset right there with those 36 cards. So
the buyer knew what he or she was doing. Got a steal. But we'll have to leave it there. Kim Harvey, thank you so much for joining the show today.
Great to be back on the show.
What Goes Up will be back next week. Until then, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal website and app, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love it if you took the time to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts so more listeners can find us. And you can find us on Twitter. Follow me at Sarah Poncek. Mike is at Reaganonymous. And you can also follow Bloomberg Podcasts at Podcasts. Again, thank you to Charlie Pellett of Bloomberg Radio and also the voice of the New York City subway system. What Goes Up is produced by Jordan Gaspore. The head of Bloomberg Podcasts is Francesca Levy. Thanks for listening. See you next time.